Hi, Rob. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Carrie.
Now, as you know, the Broadway season is now over. And as our readers know, you have reviewed a number of plays for us. I think the only one that we asked you to review that was nominated for Tony was Lucky Guy.
Yeah.
So let's start with a look at some of the ones that you reviewed for us, which I think were worth a look despite their lack of nominations.
Sure, sure. Well, also the Ann Richards Show got some nominations for performance.
Oh, it did,
for
yes.
performance, not so much for the play, but Lucky Guy definitely got best play nomination. This is Nora Ephron, who died last year, the screenwriter best known for When Harry Met Sally and You've Got Mail. She wrote a play about a colleague of hers back in the tabloid days of the 90s, Mike McAlary, rather famous for New York at least, a tabloid reporter, and he's played by Tom Hanks on stage. And so that's sort of a big feel-good, huge cast show, which, as I said in my review, it's sort of an event to see Tom Hanks. He's really wonderful on stage. I don't think the play has a great chance of going on to future life in terms of, because it's so New York specific, and it's really just a big Valentine to New York. It got great reviews here. I can't imagine it would get great reviews elsewhere. It was actually originally intended to be a screenplay, and you can sort of feel, it sort of feels like that. And it could make an interesting TV movie, I suppose. But that does influence the Tony voters sometimes when they think about the future life of a show, because some of them are producers and touring companies. That also influences the way people think of the musicals specifically. I didn't review any musicals for you, Broadway musicals at least, in this season. But the two ones that are vying for the top spot are Matilda and Kinky Boots. Both of them based on, you know, previous material, which is what musicals are tend to be based on. Even it's not just a recent trend, that goes back a long time. And those are the ones that people think are going to most smart money is on Matilda, though Kinky Boots has won a couple other earlier awards, and it's a big crowd pleaser. It's got music by Cyndi Lauper. It's based on a movie people like. Its future as a possible touring property is going to influence, at least that's what people say. A show like Memphis a couple years ago, which was a very okay show, but it was, you know, it was fun, crowd pleasing. That show can tour and is touring. And I think that's why it won for Best Musical. So it's a question of, I mean, the Tonys is a New York awards show, and it's really confined to just a few streets in New York. It's just the big Broadway theaters.
Right.
But they are thinking about the national a future of shows. It's the, you know, the commercial center of American theater.
Sure. Now, you also mentioned Matilda,
yeah,
which received many rave reviews and many nominations. You have a differing opinion of this musical, however.
Yeah. I think part of it was expectations were set so high by the reviews, both the reviews in when it played in London and then when it came here. Ben Brantley, the lead critic at the New York Times, I can't quote him directly, but he did call it something like the most subversive musical ever to come out of Britain, which I guess there aren't that many musicals that come out of Britain, but they're, you know, they're great ones, but revolutionary. And, you know, it was sold as something that would revolutionize the form. I will say that I was more or less won over by the end, and I would still recommend it to people who have the budget to do it. And it's not bad for kids like 7 and 8 year old and up. But It was not the theatrical revolution I expected. And again, sometimes expectations are set so high for these. I do feel like anything good on Broadway gets so overrated. I had a similar reaction to War Horse, which I know a lot of people loved. I was moved by about a third of it, and the rest of it I felt like was oversold. And it does feel like these imports. Sleep No More is another one, which is not on Broadway, but was also extremely overpraised. And I wonder if that's just a problem of the way, you know, theater enthusiasts. I sometimes feel like I don't want to oversell this. I really love this show. You should go see it, but be aware that, you know, it's built in. It's an occupational hazard when you're going to recommend shows to people. You want to set up their expectations. And there's so many different kinds of shows as well. A lot of the things that interested me the most this year, this past season, were off Broadway. And I reviewed a few. Well, I reviewed Here Lies Love for You, which is a musical, but it's off-Broadway. And a lot of people think off-Broadway, you know, that's crazy late-night shows and serious plays. And there's a lot of that, but there's also some great musicals happening off-Broadway. So you don't have to go to Broadway to see great musicals. And Here Lies Love was the one I reviewed for you about Imelda Marcos,
right,
with music by David Byrne and Fatboy Slim. And It has some deficits in the storytelling because it is basically just you're in a disco with the performers, but the music is so uplifting and marvelous. And then there's another show that I didn't cover for you, but it just reopened in the Meatpacking District. It's called Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812. It's a big mouthful of a title, but it's based on a part of War and Peace, and that played at a little venue off Broadway called Ars Nova last fall. Got some of the best reviews you'll ever see. Anyway, that, like Here Lies Love, is sort of an immersive spectacle that you sit in the midst of it, and it's, you know, the storytelling just takes you along. You're either on for the ride or you're not, but most people are on for it. That was another. There was one other musical I wanted to mention off Broadway. Oh, Giant, which I did not see, but it was at the Public Theater, and it was an adaptation of the Edna Ferber novel that was a famous movie with James Dean. That also had a lot of partisans, and is up for a lot of other off-Broadway awards.
What is it? Is it just that this season's off-Broadway shows have particularly appealed to you, or do you think that they appeal to you more in general because they can take more risks, or because of the themes that are allowed on them that might not be palatable for large audiences on Broadway?
Yeah, Broadway has one foot in New York, and for the sort of discerning theater audience, and one foot looking at, let's say, national. I mean, it's a people say tourists, and that is a big part of Broadway. And brand names like Matilda is a book that people have heard of, a movie people have heard of. Kinky Boots maybe not as well known, but it was a fairly well known movie. Brand names do help. One thing that's interesting about what happened on Broadway this past season was there are a lot of stars in shows, which is not a new trend. But what was new about it was that they weren't recognized generally with awards, and even with great reviews. I mean, I guess they don't always get great reviews when they appear in a show. But building a show around a marquee name does not seem to be a sure either commercial or critical or awards bait proposal. You know, Scarlett Johansson was in a major revival of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof that got okay reviews, didn't get, as far as I know, a single nomination, maybe in some design categories. Katie Holmes was in a play, not her first on Broadway, Jessica Chastain, and then Al Pacino, who I reviewed in Glengarry Glen Ross, in a production which I actually enjoyed. It got very mixed reviews. His performance was a little bit odd, but it is Al Pacino, and that's what he brings to the table. I thought it was an interesting production, and it didn't get any major awards. That was also it was a revival of a David Mamet play, and David Mamet had a new play on Broadway called The Anarchist, with Deborah Winger and Patti LuPone, that didn't get any, that closed very quickly, got terrible reviews. I think there's sort of a stink around Mamet, if I can say that. He's you know, he hasn't produced a plays that people either are paying for in large droves or that they are awarding for a long time. So I still hold out hope for every writer.
Do you think the use of celebrity in Broadway, sort of like the movie star celebrity, the big names that you're talking about, is takes away from the theater experience because people go to see that person, or because it maybe robs an up-and-coming theater actor of a position that they could have had, of a lead role or something? Or do you think, you know, they've been actors their whole lives, they have just as much right to be on the stage as anybody else?
Yeah, I mean, celebrity name casting is something that goes back so far. I mean, part of this is show business where you want to get people in the door. I do think what it is I think producers are starting to realize that people want to, they're paying a lot of money for these shows, and they want a whole experience. They don't want to just see a star. Emilia Clarke, who's fairly well known for Game of Thrones, was in a high-profile production of Breakfast at Tiffany's, in which there were reports, people trying to take photos with their cell phones, and there was a bit of a frenzy around her being in a play, but it fizzled. It was, I think people going in want to see a name, but a lot, I think what people are discovering, what producers are discovering, is that the name is often, the show is the star. Matilda, that's a brand name. I want to see what they have to say. You know, there's no stars in Matilda. No, and they're really, don't need to be. Kinky Boots, no one's heard of the actors in that. There's some great Broadway actors in that, but they're not. That Cyndi Lauper is the name that people are going for. That if there's a star in a good property that works, you know, great. Tom Hanks is a great example. But he wasn't just plucked out of, like, what star can we get? It's like he was with that project with Nora Ephron. He sort of is close to the heart of that production. So
right.
It's all there. You get a lot out of that experience.
What do you think makes a good play or a good musical? I guess it would be two different categories. But what are some qualities of each that you think make for a successful show? It might be a celebrity name. It might not. Are there other qualities?
Well, when you say successful, you mean just makes it a hit or makes it something that's worth watching?
Yeah, I guess those are two different things. I would say something really worth watching, whether or not it's necessarily commercial, or if there's something, you know, I guess if there was a surefire formula for creating commercial success, there would be no risk in Broadway at all.
Well, you know, theater is a lot about an alchemy of elements coming together and coming together in a live form that's repeatable, you know, and that only lives in the moment that you're there with it. So it's really hard to get right. I would say in general, musicals, especially the ones I mentioned, being the fact that they're actually immersive physically, points to the fact that I think musicals tend to create a world around you, and you want to get swept up in them. And you don't forget you're in a theater, but you get swept up. Music carries emotion. I feel like musicals, when they're done right, really are able to take you to another place. And plays can too. Plays tend to be more about the text and the actors. And I was talking very generally here. And if it's a marriage of the right actor and material, if they're a celebrity, that doesn't detract. You know, Alan Cumming is doing Macbeth on Broadway right now, and I guess he's a bit of a celebrity, but he's basically all but a one-man Macbeth. And that didn't get a lot of nominations. Didn't get nominations for him. Another one, Fiona Shaw is a bit of a name star. Well, she was in Testament of Mary, which I didn't review for the magazine. Angela O'Donnell did. And that was also, in a sense, snubbed. Fiona Shaw herself, who's a major actress on the world stage and been in a number of movies, didn't get any nominations. The director didn't get any. It got one for Best Play. It was adapted by Colm Tobin from his own book. And it closed very quickly, even though it got some of the best reviews, you know, from the mainstream press. You know, we can talk a little bit about Angela and I reviewed it on my own blog, The Wicked Stage. And I think both Angela and I approached it from a different point of view from some critics. I don't want to assume that other critics are the religious affiliation or not, but they're not writing for a religious audience. They're not writing as believers. And I think Angela and I both were. And I think it had a lot to say to believers about, again, from as far as I know, Colm Tobin, I'm not sure if he's a believer, if he's some kind of a semi-believer. I think he's mostly a non-believer. I don't want to get into controversy with people who know better. But I feel like artists wrestling with those characters and that story as drama is always compelling to me as a believer. And even if they go in directions where, like, well, that's not what I believe about that character, and I don't think the Mary I know or the Jesus I know would ever say that or do that,
right.
I think it really was about Mary's grief and suffering. And it took us to places where we hadn't been before, and I thought that was worthwhile. I didn't love everything about the production. I thought it was a little fancy and crazy. I would love to see just an actress just perform that in a much simpler, without all the, you know, foo-foo-rah around it. It did get a sound design and a lighting design nomination for some great lighting design, but I don't. And Angela, her take on it was unexpected. Where she differed with the production was as a mother. And you know, not to give anything away, but it's in the book. In Colm Tobin's vision, Mary sticks around for the crucifixion, and then sees that she might be in danger and leaves.
Right.
Leaves, and I it's unclear whether she knows that Jesus has died or not. And Angela made a fair point that is not what any mother would do, even the most compromised, fearful mother. Now, I'm not sure if that's literally true, that no mother would do that, but it doesn't. There's a certain truth about that perhaps Colm Tobin, he wanted to make a different kind of point about Mary and about the early Christians and about how fearful and dangerous it was. That was an interesting point, and I think it's valid. And certainly critiques from an Orthodox perspective about what it purports about Mary are certainly valid, because it doesn't hew to the
It's not exactly
the gospel. Accurate. No, yeah, exactly. Or theologically. But, you know, Mary was also a human being. Jesus was a human being. I think it's worth paying attention when artists try to get into that material. Because I also do believe that artists don't just impose themselves on it. I think that the material does affect them. I've seen very few works, even by non-believers, about Jesus and the Passion that didn't feel like they were in contact with something that they didn't quite have complete control of. And I was moved by that. And I think most of them would acknowledge that. There's some who, I think, treat the story completely flippantly. Gore Vidal, for instance. But there's some who I really feel like they come into contact with this because this is one of the great stories. And, you know, it's a great drama. They may not get all the levels that we as believers feel that they should or do ourselves. But I feel like they don't take it lightly. That's what I'm saying. So anyway, Testament of Mary was an interesting sort of an experiment on Broadway, and it didn't go too well for all concerned.
In terms of storytelling and playwriting, what elements of playwriting, I think, allow a playwright to tell a story in a way they might not otherwise be able to do so in a novel or
in another medium? Yeah. Well, that allows me to talk about some other plays this year. I feel like the presence of theater, the being there-ness of it, being there in the room with people, allows a certain level of detail and this, also the way time plays out. Again, a musical, as we've talked about, the music is setting the time at which you're taking in information. But in a play, it has the opportunity to slow down and spend time watching behavior in a way that maybe a documentary and certain filmmakers can do, but films tend to have short scenes go from one to the next. But you're spending time in a room with people. Why not spend time in the room with them? And I think one of my favorite plays of the season was called The Flick, and it was at Playwrights Horizons, which produced, in general, one of their better seasons this year. They did a lot of plays about Detroit was reviewed in the magazine. Plays about the American experience that sort of bore down into details of how we live now. And The Flick was about a movie theater in suburban Massachusetts, in which some young people worked there and had sort of aimless lives. And we spent time with them. Some people had problems with how much time we spent just watching them sweep up. But we watched their dramas play out in their small lives. Now, I found that incredibly moving to lean in, and I've never felt a theater so quiet as at the moments where we were watching these people. There's some scenes that take place in the projection booth way up at the back of the stage. You can barely see what's happening, but you have to sort of imagine. That is exciting. I think theater can also work on a huge canvas and tell big stories and have make bold gestures, and that's interesting too. But I do think there's this way that being in the room with the person, with the people on stage and that world, I think can get us to look at each other differently, to look at behavior differently. A couple years ago, I wrote a piece for America about my sort of spiritual sense of theater. And to me, it's like storytelling made incarnate, made flesh. And to me, that it's like it's a communion. You know, I don't want to use all these religious words for it, but that is really how I feel. I feel like it is like a communion that comes together for a moment, expresses something larger, and then we go about our lives and are changed or transformed by it or in some small way. And again, I think music is a I don't want to say it's a shortcut, but it's a way that plugs directly into emotions that we can't express. Plays have to work with words and behavior, and they have to work a little harder to get into that, you know, emotional core that music does. But a great play, I mean, it's a cliche, but great plays are really like, playwrights are like poets, or it's like music when the dialogue, the rhythm of the dialogue really goes well. I think David Mamet at his best was like, his plays have a musical beat to them, you know. You can't, you know, neglect that.
Right. I saw Katie Roche this year at the Mint.
Oh, right.
Actually Angela O'Donnell also saw, yeah. And wrote about in our magazine. And I was sort of surprised by how much just takes place in one set, in mm-hmm. one scene, in mm-hmm. a living room.
Right.
Just using a single setting to tell so much of a story that
right.
is, and how willing I am to suspend my sense of disbelief about what they're seeing out a window that I know looks onto nothing but the set yeah. of the soundstage
yeah.
and coming through a door from the outside, you know,
yeah, yeah.
There's these things where if you were watching a movie and it didn't look totally believable,
yeah.
it would get taken out of the story. But in a way, in a play, I find myself willing to suspend my sense of disbelief and get drawn into it.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that in plays, not everything has to look exactly, you know, accurate or believable in a sense.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of plays that have been written over the years that change settings and that do fluid time transitions. But I do feel like the core of a lot of, especially American playwriting, is finding stories that can be told in one setting. One of the best productions of the past season, which we haven't talked about, was and is up for some nominations in revival categories, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, this new production of it, which was pretty revelatory. If your only experience of it is the famous movie with Richard Burton and Liz Taylor, and maybe you read it in high school, and you know, that is one of the classic American plays because it's in one setting over one night. There's a break or two there's an intermission, and there's intermissions in the behavior that we're watching. It's not as complete from point A to point B, but like the flick, it's a play in which we watch behavior play out and in one room. And yeah, if you start to think in a play, you know, would that really all happen in this room? And I'd like to see where they're talking about. I'd like to. And if all the interesting action is happening off stage, if you think that too much, then this really probably isn't a play or a good play. It should be a movie or it should be something else, or they should find some other way to tell it in a more fluid way. Another production I loved this past season that's going to be at the Public Theater this next year was this great production of A Good Person of Szechuan, which is a Bertolt Brecht play. Not done that often, but it was done by a little company called The Foundry at La Mama. And that's something where it's sort of in one setting, but it kind of encompasses the whole world through this little village. It's just a beautiful, beautiful play. It's a play with music, so that's something to look forward to in the next season.
Well, it sounds like we have a lot to look forward to this upcoming season.
We do.
And a whole new way to look at it, thanks to some of your insights. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Carrie.